Oh, we'll just start the class momentarily. Hope everybody is doing well today. And if we just follow the on-screen messages. Today's class will be recorded. It will be placed online live subsequent to the class, usually within a half an hour after the class is over, in the audio files link. It's the seventh link down on your left-hand side on the screen. And we're going to continue more with a question and answer period today. There's a follow-up of last week's where we were discussing proof versus faith. And some emails have come in. I just felt we'll just review that and address some of the questions, and also like to open up the floor to your questions in case there's any other questions either on the topic or off. So again, we'll start shortly, and we'll just get an audio confirmation. So once you hear the sound, just type audio OK on screen, and that'll confirm for us that everybody's picking up the audio fine, and then we'll start with the class. Okay, so we'll just start momentarily. Good to see everybody today. Good to see you, Nissim, Hector, Meira, Eshio, Andrew in New Jersey. Gene, good to see you. Hope the move went well. I understand you're now living in Missouri. And Native, good to see you as well. Enjoyed the emails back and forth. And my name is Rabbi Moshe Ben Chaim. I'll be giving the class today. Again, it'll be more of a follow-up to last week's discussion. We're going to go to Maimonides and also Rabbi Bachya, who's the author of Duties of the Heart, both very brilliant rabbis, great leaders of Jewish thought and philosophy. And we'll see what their exact words are on the issue of proof versus faith regarding Judaism. Okay, Gene, my pleasure. Good to see you. Okay, Mitchell 114, thank you for that. Thank you for the confirmation. And just a few more moments, we'll start the class. Okay, good to see you, Alex, Isaac of Thornhill. Okay, once you have the audio, just type in audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That'll confirm that you're picking up the audio fine, and we'll start. Okay, Meira in Johannesburg, thank you very much for the audio confirmation. And again, I'd like today's forum also to, the 30-minute class to also avail you to questions that you might have. So we'll use that for your questions as well. All right, Chad in Florida, thanks, good to see you. Pam in Missouri, Scott in New Jersey. And again, if you do get any on-screen errors, any type of runtime errors or Microsoft script errors, just click the send button at the bottom of your screen. That'll bring the chat window back. Sometimes there's a glitch. That's just how it resolves it. Okay, Isaac and Thornhill, thank you. Pam, Missouri, thank you. Okay, looks like the audio is working all right. And I guess we'll begin. I'll read you an email. And this is not just one person's email. This we received numerous times. And I think it's important that this is something that is addressed. And again, it has to be addressed over and over again. I definitely invited the person who wrote the email to join us. If he is there, I hope that you'll interact. I'm not going to mention names, of course. Let me read you the email, and then we're going to go to some sources, and we'll discuss it amongst ourselves. And I quote the email. When I usually read your articles with interest, I fail to understand your categorization of Judaism as a non-faith-based religion and only based on proofs. All right, so the writer is saying that he disagrees, and he says that Judaism is really faith-based. So he fails to understand the categorization of Judaism as non-faith-based religion. He continues, quote, all 13 of the Rambam's principles, that's Maimonides, all 13 of the Rambam's principles of faith, as he translates it, are about just that, and he puts in quotes, faith. Failure to accept even one of these most certainly faith principles is tantamount to heresy. All right, so he's understanding the Maimonides' 13 principles as faith. When Maimonides himself did not write, he said the word amen or emunah, is what even the Siddurim have. The question is, what does the word amen mean, or emuna? So people translate it loosely to mean a trust or a faith. He continues, quote, when one can argue that Jews must question and strive to seek truth, there are many things in our religion that have no logic, no reason, and we must accept them upon faith, including the red heifer, the paraduma, 6 days of creation, the chosen people, etc. The entire Kabbalistic lore is premised on quote-unquote faith in an underlying dimension that complements the Torah but can only be assimilated into one's belief system through faith. I look forward to your clarification. Okay, so clearly his statements here are dealing he's approaching it that he has a concept somehow that Judaism has to be faith-based and not based on proof. And he tries to bring support that there are things in Judaism which are not based on logic and they just have to be accepted. So let me just address those first. Those are errors because it states openly that King Solomon knew the reasons for all the laws, except for Paraduma. But that does not apply to Moses. Moses even knew about Paraduma. All right, Moses was a higher level intelligent than any person before or after. So the first point that we're bringing up is, you know, this individual, which is not just, it's not reserved just to this person who wrote in. Many, many Jews have this concept that Judaism is faith-based. Many Orthodox rabbis have this. The question is this true, or is it their own idea, and why is it so appealing? So we'll have to look at the authorities and use our own experience from life as well to determine whether or not faith outweighs proof. I mean, just on the surface, intuitively, we would say proof. It is something which outweighs faith. The reason being is followed, that faith in something does not require any proof. By definition, somebody who says that I have faith in something and I don't need proof is stating that proof is not part of his modus operandi, the reasoning for the lifestyle that he selects. In such a case, if a person is supporting, if an Orthodox Jew, and if sadly an Orthodox rabbi, a leader with a voice, tells people that faith is how you should live your life, what he's doing is he is now arming any Jew and any Jew for Jesus to successfully claim that Jesus is greater than Moses, because since we're not living our lives based on any proof and faith overrules any proof, so what are you going to say to your young son or daughter that comes home one day from yeshiva, from Hebrew school, and says, Mom, Dad, I have more faith in Jesus than in Moses. Well, if we've taught them that faith overrules proof, then you have no way to argue, because you're basically saying that argument and reasoning is something which takes a back seat to faith. So that's one inherent flaw with the position of faith. You're now saying that faith is why I should live a certain way, and then somebody with an opposite belief can equally claim their view is proper because they have faith in that stronger. Okay, I see a lot of more people had just logged on, so let's just do one more audio check. If everybody could just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. As the class is now getting started, let's make sure that all the discussions, everybody's picking up. So if everybody could just type that in again, audio okay at the bottom of your screen, and we will continue. But the thing to ponder right now is this concept that you could have two people with opposite faiths. They can't both be right if they're opposites. Reason tells you this. So there's no escaping reason. And therefore, the attraction to faith has to be understood, but it also has to be refuted. And I think the simple refutation is that when you see two opposite faiths going at it, they're basically saying that ours is right and yours is wrong. The other religion or faith is now saying, no, our opinion is correct and yours is wrong. But since it's not based on anything, what type of argument can you offer? So we're arming young Jewish students with the ability to have a very strong defense if they would like to defect from Judaism and convert to Catholicism or to Christianity. Since our leaders today are now making this blatant error and this fatal error to endorse faith, you're now basically giving any person the ability to defend themselves if he wants to become faithful to Jesus more than Moses. Okay, so that's a very big problem. And then, of course, we'll take a look, as I promised, we will look in Maimonides' words and as well as the duties of the heart, Rabbi Bachya, and see exactly what they stated on this. But keep in mind also, the Torah that we have is synonymous with Moses' words. That's why it's called the Five Books of Moses, or Moshe Rabbeinu in Hebrew. But I like to use the English counterpart this way, if there are a lot of people that are joining us and not familiar with the Hebrew, that everybody can understand. So, if you understand Hebrew, you'll understand both Hebrew and English. So again, when Moses spoke to the people, he did not ask them for faith. None of the prophets asked the Jews for faith. And Moses, being the greatest prophet ever, that's in Devarim, that's 34:10. At the very end of the five books, states clearly that there will never rise a prophet greater than Moses. All right, so this completely refutes Jesus and any other type of an individual character that came subsequent to Moses to try to claim any divine inspiration and to overrule any of Moses' words, especially since it also says in the Torah, and this is important as well, a very important quote is in Devarim, Deuteronomy 13:1. That's one of the few places in the Torah where God says, do not add or do not subtract to the Torah. That means the Torah itself is intact and complete and cannot be added onto. Even the prophets, as a rabbi once taught, they only come to embellish the words of the Torah. So the five books from Genesis through Deuteronomy, from Bereishis through Devarim, are complete. And God knows the future and does not have to update because he didn't realize something that would happen in the future. The claims as well as a new covenant that a lot of Christians will quote in order to try to support their view that God renewed his whole system is putting God in contradiction because God said earlier in Devarim that he's never going to renew the Torah and it's never going to be added to or subtracted to. You're not allowed to do that. That would be violating a prohibition. Those are God's words. So again, we have clear proofs, and this should always be the position that we stand in, and not to try to negotiate and dispute Christianity or Catholicism with the missionaries based on their arguments. Bring them right back to God's words. That's it. Everybody agrees of the Old Testament, meaning the Chumash, the five books of Moses. And there we have our proofs. They're clear. So again, the points that we're bringing up to argue and to refute faith is that, you see, the Torah itself demands evidence. Moses told the people, remember what your eyes saw. Don't forget what your eyes saw at Har Sinai. Okay, that's something which Moses used to make sure the people remember the truth that they got the Torah from God. So the whole Torah is based on God's orchestration of the revelation at Sinai. This is why God orchestrated that whole event, that there should be a proof for those people and all future generations. The Torah says all those who are not here today as well have now come into the obligation to follow the Torah based on proof. God did not ask the Jews for faith. Moses did not ask the Jews for faith. None of the prophets asked for faith because we have a faculty called reasoning that we can derive proofs. And when you have a proof for something, then you understand why another view is not valid. If, however, a person is living based on faith, so you ask the person, well, why do you select your faith and not somebody else's? Well, if he has no proof, then he has no way to explain why he should pitch his religion over another one, which happens to be a very good argument against the Christians and the missionaries. Because since it's saying everything's based on faith, well, tell them, have faith in what I'm saying. So they can't defend themselves since they're saying faith is the way that they operate. They will not be able to resort to reason. And once they try to use reasoning, then you stop them dead in the tracks and you show them, excuse me, didn't you just try to use an argument? An argument is based on reasoning, but you just claimed that your religion is based on faith, so which is it? They will then see their contradiction. But what you really want to do is show them that they really value proof, and that's why they engaged proof as a means to argue against you. So just very, you know, and you stick to these, you know, to these arguments. I'm not saying that we should go out and start proselytizing. I'm saying that a lot of times students are attacked, and I was told, I think just last night, somebody was telling me on the phone that there was some Jew for Jesus that was standing outside of a kosher restaurant in Manhattan. Luckily, the person he approached was very well-versed and was able to disarm the Jew for Jesus. But 9 out of 10 times, Jews are not taught the fundamentals. Now, getting back to the email that I quoted earlier, the word amen actually means proof. As Rabbi Mann had taught, he showed it's actually a quote that when the 10 brothers of Joseph came to Egypt, so Joseph had concocted an accusation that they were spies, and they defended themselves saying that we're not, and talking about the lineage from Jacob. So Joseph finally says, "Bezos tibachum, with this you will be tested." And then ve'yamnu devarichem, that your words will be proved. But the word amen, you see clearly, is used in the Torah to mean proof. So to take the word amen and translate it as faith, as the person who wrote the email regarding Maimonides' 13 principles of faith, is not accurate. Maimonides based his principles on proofs, on reasoning. Okay. And let me just go on screen, see if there's any statements. Scott is asking, is Deuteronomy 34:10 written in the past tense? Yes, the word come is past tense. But we'll go into that. The understanding, though, of the rabbis, which is unanimous, is that that is the verse. I'm not going to go into the tenses, but I will say that the rabbis unanimously refer to Moshe, to Moses, as the greatest prophet before or after his time. That's something which is no dispute. Okay. And Jean in Missouri is asking, do you think that confusion is caused by the way the words religion, belief, faith can be used interchangeably? Yes, I'm sure there is much confusion. Hopefully what the idea that we'll come up with today, which I'll now start reading from Maimonides, we'll see what the actual words are. But again, keep in mind, Moses asked the people for evidence. He said, remember Sinai. Don't forget what your eyes saw. And I want you to have one more piece of information in what I'll call your arsenal, because we should have, it says also, da malaheshav abikaris, you should know how to answer a heretic, which also means you should know how to answer anybody who is disputing the Torah. And part of the heresies that we hear from other religions is that God is physical, that he implanted himself, inseminated himself somehow in Mary, and then Jesus is now God incarnate, and so on and so forth. So this means God taking on a physical form. Besides it being a ludicrous idea and something which Judaism unanimously wars against, Moses himself tells the people that don't forget what your eyes saw. He says, the chultumut, he says that a voice you heard, kol, you heard a voice, the chultumun einchem roim, but any form, meaning any visual, you did not see at Sinai. And this, he says over and over to them. And you heard the words speaking to you from fire at least 8 times in Deuteronomy. It says this within one or two parshios. So what was Moses telling to the people? That remember that you only heard a voice, the chol temuna ein chem roem, but any form you did not see. Why does he say this to the people? And why is the concept of making idolatry, physical objects, anything that you see in the heavens above or the earth below, whether it's a people or animals or fish, this is telling you that there is no form to God. That's the whole point. And that, I believe, is also the reasoning why you had the command at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai. God told Moses a second time, warn the people, surround the mountain, don't let them go up to the mountain. Well, the question would be, what is so wrong about going to the mountain? I mean, we know God is not there. It's a fire that he created, and it's a voice that he created. God has no vocal cords, so it's not him speaking, right? God has no mouth. He's not physical. It's a created voice. However, since the people had a desire to go up to the mountain, that's why God warned against it, because the desire was stemming from an innate feeling that there was something in terms of the proximity of the mountain. Okay? This is why he told them not to go to the top of the mountain. Because he was warning against that emotion from having any expression. Don't express the emotion that you feel that there's something to be seen if you go on the mountain. There's nothing to be seen in connection with God. God is not physical. He doesn't take up space. King Solomon said, the heavens and the heavens of the heavens cannot hold you. How much more this house that I've created? Meaning to say that even that which God creates, the best way to put it, is that which God creates is not something which encompasses God. The whole concept of encompassing means geographically or location or spatial relationships. All this is something which is impossible in connection with God. I mean, it must be something you understand clearly. This is why God told the people, don't go to the mountain. There's nothing to see. And if you do go and you express that belief, then you're killed. What happened to the 57,000 people that ran to look inside the ark when it was returned from the Philistines? Later on, a few hundred years later, the Philistines and the Jews were at war, and they took the ark, and when they finally were smitten with plague after plague because of having the ark, they sent it back on a wagon with cows and offerings to appease the Jews and God. When the Jews saw the ark finally coming back to the Israeli borders, they were so excited, they ran and they opened up the ark and they looked inside. And you know what God did? God killed them. God killed the 57,000. And there's some commentaries on the exact number, but the plain reading of the text means a large number, a very significant quantity of Jews, or very significant Jews, were wiped out because they expressed a feeling that I can see something in connection with God. This is what they were expressing when they opened up the ark and looked inside. There's nothing inside the ark. God is not there. There is no place to God. So this is something which was being warned against. And Moses told the people, not only don't go up the mountain, but later on he reminds them, don't forget, you only heard a voice. You saw no form. And Christianity clearly violates these words when they say that God now is Jesus. All right, so it's important. Okay, let me just go on screen and see any of the comments, and then we'll go further, and I'd like to read to you Maimonides and Rabbi Bachya. So again, just to recap up to this point before I take the questions, we're showing how faith is something which was very popular today. And again, the reasoning why, and I see a question, Scott, in Pesach, we'll get to that one second. And if everybody else could just hold off on the questions right now, because I don't want to miss any of the entries on screen, so let's just pause on the typing for a moment. I just want to reiterate the position we're taking, and I'd like to answer the questions, and then we'll move on. But I would like to just underline the point that why is faith so appealing? See, one of the attractions of faith, and if we understand the appeal, we can understand better how to remove the appeal and deal with it in a rational approach and try to understand, is this the right way? Is this true or not? But faith carries with it the appeal, number one, that the person is so devoted, I don't have to have any answers. See, that's something which satisfies the ego and satisfies an imagined feeling that now God will take care of me. Look how devoted I am. This is a very strong appeal. And there are many emotional appeals, but I'm just trying to express to you my understanding as to what are some of the attractions to faith. Okay. And another appeal of faith is that there are so many other religions and cultures that base themselves on it because they have no proof. Precisely. That's why it's faith-based. But since there are so many others that are following faith and we hear it so often, so many, many Jews succumb to the innate emotion that we all have, and that's the need for approval. And that we feel that there is proof or that there is support in masses. But everything in life should be looked at carefully and rationally. Is this a good reason to be following that type of lifestyle or not? Am I giving into an emotion or not? Once we can isolate this and be honest with ourselves and talk openly, I think this is a very important step in terms of understanding why it may have a grip on us. So it's something to reflect. And again, reflection is also something which, unfortunately, is not a very big commodity today. We have so many distractions and so many involvements, and you know, it is hard to make a living for many people, and you have to apply yourself to work and take care of the family, pay for tuition, and you need some entertainment, some downtime. When does the time come, though, for us to stop and reflect and evaluate our assumptions, our principles? Well, this is something that should be done on a regular basis. Okay, so that's just, I'm just inserting there. I'm injecting two ideas that I had in terms of why faith is such a pull. But every human being, if they stop, they will be able to find something in their life that they can show with proof. And since that's the case, why should proof stop when it comes to religion? See, that's where another unspoken rule is with the other religions and with a lot of Jews, unfortunately. People feel that religion is not something which is subject to the rigor of proof. No, that's an area of life that I'm just faithful, but everything else in life I have to analyze before I go for a job interview, and while I'm in the interview, I have contracts that are written so carefully, make sure that I've got my 401k, make sure that I have an escalating scale in terms of what my pay will be over the next couple of years in the contract. Everything is done with proof. Everything is done so clearly in college, in classes, science, math, everything we see around us. Science is all based on proofs. I'm not saying that everything in science and math is proven, but it is based on proof, meaning proof is available. Every human being knows that. That is something which is a very good stepping stone in terms of saying that why shouldn't religion be based on it? And since the other religions have no proofs, this is why it is faith-based. You'll look at how much Christianity has to cannibalize Judaism, and how the Quran does the same exact thing. They basically have a principle, if you can't beat them, cannibalize them. That's basically what Quran is. The Quran takes responsibility for Moses. They said, we gave Moses to the Jews, we gave Jesus to the Christians. And we are not coming to say anything new, but we are coming to continue in the same footsteps as Abraham and Jesus and Moses. Basically, they're trying to hide behind this assumed facade that we are just embellishing your true ideas, you Jews and you Christians. But in fact, if you read it, it's full of hatred, and it's not based on anything on proof. Okay, let me just go to screen now and just take a few of the comments. Okay. Pesach is writing, do we have the right to define our souls and the meaning of our own lives? I'm not sure what you mean, Pesach, to define our souls. So if you could clarify what you mean, please. Scott is writing. And again, if you could just hold off on Smitty, just please hold off on the entries because it's causing the entries above yours to jump up, and I can't read them as they're jumping up. Okay. Scott is saying, you skirted the question. You're assuming that the Talmudic rabbis have the truth, but you based, again, just jumping up. Let me just copy out. And this way I can look at it without it removed from the screen. Okay. And again, if we could just hold off on the entries. No problem, Smitty. Okay. So let's all hold off on the entries just for one moment, just so I can get to the bottom of the screen. Okay. Scott is asking as follows. You are assuming that the Talmudic rabbis have the truth, but you based your argument against the validity of Christianity on the biblical verse that there will never rise a prophet greater than Moses, implying that nobody can overrule the teachings of Moses. You're trying to give the impression that you are basing your argument on the Old Testament, but you're really basing it on the Talmud. Okay. So you're saying it's based on what the rabbis in the Talmud had understood the verse to mean. Okay? That's fine. I stand corrected. All right. Next entry is. All right, but that again is the unanimous view, Scott. That is the unanimous view of Judaism. And that is something which all the leaders have consented on, and the Talmud is something which is unanimously accepted. Okay, so that does not belittle the veracity. And let me just read now. College Mom is writing as follows. I received an email to join the discussion and ask my question. I am new to this, so please bear with me. I would like to know how to deal with a very smart college freshman who is kosher and is basically was a strong Jew prior to age 17. Well, since he was a junior in high school, he has been seeing a non-Jewish girl, and we, his family, are devastated. What do we do? We even tried counseling to no avail. I have spoken to two of our local rabbis, but that did nothing either. He thinks it doesn't matter to him anymore if his future wife is Jewish, yet he wants his children raised Jewish. We have explained everything to him, but nothing works. Okay, just since this is a little bit off the issue, and I'm addressing a college mom on this one, I would suggest that there's a contact link on the website here. I think we should really speak about this. Feel free to call anytime later on this afternoon. I'd be more than happy to speak to you about this, as well as your son. Let's talk about it, and let's hear his opinions. And it is good, though, that he's saying that he wants his children to be raised Jewish. So you see that he does have values there that have not been shaken yet, although he has compromised himself in certain areas. Okay, so let's take that up since we're really approaching a different point here. So I hope that's satisfactory to you, College Mom. Okay, Smitty is writing, Moses was never deified. That is correct, and the Torah goes out of the way to talk about Moses' sins. Okay, I'm not sure if you're writing to me or to somebody else on here, Smitty. Okay, let me just go back down to Pesach. I mean, do we have the right to experience our own souls and live accordingly? Again, you say, do we have the right to experience our own souls and live accordingly? Well, we have free will, Pesach, if that's what you're asking. I don't know what you mean about do we have the right to experience our own souls. We have intelligence. It's God's will that we have that we use it. Okay, Nissim is writing, faith alone is more attractive emotionally as it releases its adherence of personal responsibility, and B, it provides a comfort level for those who haven't fully matured intellectually. Very good point, Nissim. And I hope that the article that you're going to be contributing to the Jewish Times will include that. That is a very important point. I'm actually going to save that. You articulated that very well. Okay, let's just go up to the other questions. Okay, it looks like the rest was conversation. All right, so again, in terms of with the on-screen, again, you can feel free to type your questions or your comments on screen. The only thing is, if you're cross-talking, what it's going to do is going to confuse me. I mean, it's fine with me, but I guess the best thing in terms of me being able to respond to your questions on the topic is if we just limit the on-screen text to questions. And let's also just do them at, you know, when I prompt you. This way I'm not looking at the screen the whole time. I don't want to miss anybody's points. Okay. If everything is clear up to this point, and we understand the problems with faith, now let's look and see what we can say about proof. Okay. And Hector is making a good point. He's saying there is faith in the sense that it is proof-based, meaning like Judaism, that you have faith in God after experiencing Him at Sinai. And then there is a blind faith like that of Christianity. Well, it's not a blind faith because Christianity is not based on anything real that ever took place. We are basing our trust in God that He will continue to provide for us based on his words, but also based on Sinai. Christianity, however, is based on nothing. So it's faith in something which was never proven. It's faith in the imaginary. Okay. All right, Smitty saying, read my question. Didn't the rabbis violate the Torah when they wrote down the oral? No, Smitty, because we have an injunction in the Torah that says, it's called Horos Shoah, a rule for a temporary moment. Meaning, for the sake of the Torah, we're allowed to violate something temporarily. That's why Elijah at Mount Carmel was able to offer sacrifices where sacrifices were currently forbidden. But he was able to do that because it was for the sake of proving who was true, God or the idolatrous Baal. So that was correct. You are allowed to temporarily suspend a law, but not permanently. So it's not a violation of the rabbis at all to write down the oral. They wrote it down because their estimation was that since it was now being lost, if it was not written down, the complete oral law would be forfeited. And they said it is better that we now suspend the law that prohibits writing the oral law in order that we can salvage the Torah in its oral form. Okay, it's not a rationalization. That is the exact law. We have that injunction in the Torah. All right. And let's just see if there's any more. I'm just looking for Pesach to please just clarify again. You wrote, do we have the right to experience our own souls and live accordingly? Again, so Pesach, we want to, there you are. Okay, he's asking as follows. Pesach writes, do I have the right to think for myself? Answer is, of course, yes. That's God's will. To be myself, to realize my own self, express my own life, taking only the ethics from the Torah. Yes, you're saying is completely congruent with the Torah. It's not only right, but it's actually the reason why we have the ability to think and to prove is in order to arrive at the truth. I'm not sure if you were asking on something that I said. It sounds like something may have been misunderstood. Okay. All right. Let me now read. Let's hold off on the entries, except for Pesach. Please just clarify if I have your question right. Okay, Smitty, please hold off on the entries now. All right, let me read to you now from Maimonides. This is in the last chapter, one of the last pages of his book, The Guide for the Perplexed. Okay, and this is based on, I'm bringing these quotes in just so you have grounding, just to see what the great authorities have spoken about regarding proof versus faith. So he says as follows. Quote, this is Maimonides now. We must first learn the truths by tradition. After this, we must be taught how to prove them. And then investigate the actions that help to improve man's ways. The idea that man will have to render an account, meaning pay the price, in our jargon, the idea that man will have to answer for these things in the order described, meaning to learn them from tradition and then to prove them, is expressed by our sages in the following passage. When man comes to, and he quotes now, this is the Talmud, I believe, he's quoting. Quote, when man comes to the trial, he is first asked. And this is talking about when man, there's a Talmudic portion that talks about what is man asked upon his death. And this is what he is asked. When man comes to the trial, after he passes away, he is first asked as follows. Have you fixed certain times for the study of the law? Have you been engaged in the acquisition of wisdom? And have you derived from one thing another thing? End quote. That's the end of the Talmudic quote. I'll read it again. Have you fixed times for learning? Have you engaged in acquiring wisdom? And have you derived one thing from another thing? So Maimonides concludes and he states, quote, this proves that our sages distinguished between the knowledge of the law on the one hand and wisdom on the other as the means of proving the lessons taught in the Torah by correct reasoning. Okay. So Maimonides is saying clearly that proof is something which is demanded. And keep in mind that we have that capacity. So it's very puzzling why people are so they gravitate so powerfully towards faith. But I did give some suggestions what the emotional draw is. But again, since they are rooted in an emotional lifestyle, as Nissen pointed it out, that is where they get the greatest satisfaction. I have to do very little exertion, and I could be a religious person in my own mind right away. How? I just believe. So this satisfies the person's need for accomplishment, their need to be sanctioned in their activities by God. It's a very quick route. It's a panacea. People don't want to work and to exert themselves and to understand what is it that God wants, and to use reasoning. But you see, the greatest minds said the opposite. Now let me read to you another quote. This is from a book called Duties of the Heart. In Hebrew, it's Choves HaLevavos. And This is Rabbi Bachian, and he reads as follows. He says, I'll read you the whole paragraph just so you have the context. This is in his introduction. It's page 25 in the Feldheim edition. He says as follows. I asked one of those who are thought to be Torah scholars some of the questions on the science of the inner life, meaning perfection and thought, that I have shared with you here. And he answered me that relying on tradition can substitute for independent thought in all these matters. My answer to him was that this is acceptable only in the case of children or people uneducated men or women who do not study, meaning anybody who has not developed yet. All right, and also it applies to uneducated men who, because of limited perception and comprehension, cannot reason on their own. But, whoever has the intellectual capacity to verify what he receives from tradition and yet is prevented from doing so by his own laziness or because he takes lightly God's commandments in Torah, he will be punished for this and held accountable for negligence. So clearly, Rabbi Bachia is also stating that a person has the ability to verify. He continues on the next page, and he says a few paragraphs later, if, however, you possess intelligence and insight, and through these faculties you are capable of verifying the fundamentals of the religion and the foundations of the commandments which you have received from the sages in the name of the prophets, then it is your duty to use these faculties until you understand the subject so that you are certain of it, both by tradition and by force of reasoning. If you disregard and neglect this duty, you fall short in the fulfillment of what you owe your Creator. Okay. And he says later on, and he says, be diligent in the study of Torah and know what to answer, what answer to give to a heretic. That we quoted earlier. That's Pirkei Avos 2:14. So if you want to write down that quote, know what to answer a heretic. So that means you have to have knowledge, you have to have proof. So you see clearly that the rabbis are endorsing our leaders, the ones that we have the Masorah from, the whole tradition, what the whole Torah is built on, the transmission from Moses down to us. And the great leaders, like we say, from Moses to Moses, meaning Moses the prophet to Moses Maimonides, there's a saying, from Moses to Moses, no one rose as great as Moses. So Maimonides is viewed as beyond compare in terms of halachic and philosophic authority. And this statement is clear. Judaism is based on reasoning and proof. Okay. Let's just go on screen now, see some of the questions. All right, let's hold off on the entries for a moment so I can see the statements. Okay. And Scott is writing, you are clearly speaking from an assumption that the rabbis, whoever they are, define the religion. This needs to be established. I'm not saying that it can't be, but I rarely hear anybody trying to prove it. I do ask myself, why should the written Torah be any more authoritative than the oral? And I can accept the authority of the written, but how do I know that the oral wasn't corrupted over time? Okay, that's it's a discussion. Not for right now. I'd be glad to take it up with you, Scott. So if you'd like to send an email in, please put that in exactly as you have it, and I'll get back to you on that. You could also use the website. There is a search feature that you could look for the articles that deal with oral law. So you could use that as your keyword. And I know that I have written on that in the past. Okay. Let's see what we have here. Okay, Scott in New Jersey is writing. My friend Charlie is here, a Christian who would like to ask a question as follows. Can't faith and logic coexist in one's pursuit of coming to understand the Bible? It should be based on proof. Faith is not something which is proving anything, so it is useless in terms of determining truth. If you're concerned with truth, again, I'm addressing now Charlie. If you're concerned with truth, so truth is always based on what is proven. So I don't see where faith comes in. And College Mom is asking, I need to go. Please tell me what number to call. Okay, the number you'll see on the contacts link. Okay, that's on the left-hand side of your screen, College Mom. Towards the bottom of the list, you'll see that there's a contact link over there, and there's phone numbers there. Okay. And Pesach is asking, Viktor Frankl has far more authority than either Maimonides or the author duties at heart. We have a basic human right to be who we are, American Jews. Our souls are connected to the infinite, even as much as anyone who lived in ancient past. Okay, well, the Jewish system is not built on the principle that you are citing there, Pesach. Okay, and what about the Noahites? Some Noahites don't learn Torah. So what are Noahites supposed to be doing? Well, this is addressed to a person called Test. Noahides do have to learn Torah in as much as they are keeping the seven commands minimum. If they want to keep more commands, they should be learning more. There's only a few commands that are off limits to Noahides, and that's for a separate reason, that the role of the Jew as the authority in Torah should not be obscured. Since the Jew has the obligations and he is the one commanded by God to teach the rest of the world, the Jew alone has to be positioned and maintain an exclusive position in the world's eyes as being the exclusive Torah educator. So therefore, if a Noahide would keep Sabbath or put on tefillin or keep the holidays, and now he would appear to be doing something exactly as a Jew, so other people might go to the Noahide to be taught Judaism. But since he doesn't have the proper training and the obligations and the mission from God to teach, so then he's not going to be teaching Judaism in its true form. It's if a Noahide converts, then he's just like we are, and he becomes a teacher. Some of our greatest teachers were Gentiles who converted. Our Messiah, Mashiach, is a descendant of a convert, who was Ruth the Moabite, who converted, had King David, King Solomon, and a descendant of King David will be Mashiach. So we do not view any human being as any less or more than another. There's just separate roles that God has in his plan. Okay. And thank you, Scott. That is what I'm doing. I actually did copy and paste the text. Okay, if there are any other questions, now you can enter them. I will look on screen for your questions. Okay, Pesach is saying as follows. Are you saying that we have no right to be modernist Jewish thinkers? You can think as you want. There's no prohibition, Pesach, on thinking. First of all, the thinking should be guided by pure reason. Faith is not, doesn't have a place there. And if you're studying what Torah is, there are guidelines. There are methods by which we understand. There's reasoning, and it takes many, many years to really master the work, the Talmud. And to just feel that we can come in and start coming up with our own views of what's true is arrogant and it's foolish. We look at the greatest minds had to immerse themselves for decades. And then they emerged as thinkers, as having a handle on what Judaism is about. That's the big problem. People feel that they can get God's knowledge overnight. It doesn't work that way. Okay, test, my pleasure. So think and think clearly, but get yourself a very good teacher, Pesach. And in that manner, you're going to be able to have a true understanding of what Torah is about. And believe me, I've been studying it for 30 years myself. From the point I did not come from observant background, and later on I decided to start studying. And I realize now, 30 years later, after studying, that there is so much more out there, and how many decades were necessary to have a handle on the proper outlook and to understand the themes that the rabbi spoke about, and how to ask a question and answer it properly, how to go through the Talmud. The Talmud is so cryptic, and that is where the greatest training comes in. Okay, Victor and Einstein could say many things about being a Jew. Whether that reflects God's Torah Judaism is something for you to determine in time, Pesach. Okay, any other questions? You can type them on the bottom of the screen. But again, not to... to repeat myself, but in order that it's clear to us, the leaders and the whole system, the whole body of Judaism is synonymous with Moses, with Moshe Rabbeinu, and he demanded that we recall an event, that we use evidence in terms of our commitment to Judaism. Okay, so Pesach, so in time, I hope that you have studied it. I mean, have you studied it with... Yes, rabbis are just people, Pesach. That's true. But the system that we have, if you learnt under the tutelage of a Talmudic scholar, you would know that there's a system of authority in the Torah in terms of halacha. There's also a system of thought. All right, so I don't know if you're arguing that. Ask your question directly, Pesach. And Ruthie in Phoenix is asking, what is the best way to encourage one's adult children to want to study the Torah? Well, if they're coming, I mean, I really, really don't know the background, Ruthie. Best thing really would be to email me directly on that. I'd like to get a little bit of background. It's hard to answer because it's a very individual question you're asking. All right, Ruthie? That's for Ruthie in Phoenix. And Pesach, feel free to be very direct in what you're asking. So this way I can be direct in an answer. If there's a specific point that you're contesting, say the point. It seems like you're speaking in generalities. I'm not sure exactly what you are asking. All right. That seems to be all the questions at this point. Okay, Scott is saying as follows. Many rabbis are excessive in their accusation that students are arrogant or trying to form views of their own. Okay, I'm sure that's true. Every person needs to think for himself to some degree, not only to get through life, but to develop faith. It is not arrogant to think. A person needs to combine thinking with learning from others. I agree. Thus, even a lowly person, like myself, has the right to and should think. Of course, I agree 100%. And I should see what better educated and experienced people have to say. Agreed as well. If Judaism is saying otherwise, forget it. I've learned that much by this point in my life, and not to let anybody prevent me from thinking. We're in complete agreement, Scott. Pesach, I don't know what you're talking about, and stuff. I don't know what that means. Okay, Ruthie, very good. So I look forward to getting your email. And Ruthie, please outline, you know, the person you're talking about. Let me get a good background. And again, I'd be more than happy to talk with this young adult if they have questions. And again, they could use this form as well. We do this class once a week. But, you know, emails are something which you could take advantage of as well. Again, so the idea, again, that I just wanted to reiterate, and we'll close up shortly, is that we have intelligence. God gave us reasoning. Moses and all the greatest minds demanded that we use proof and reasoning and did not ask that we just have blind faith, because blind faith does not get our minds to see something as true. So what use is it if I just mumble the words, I believe in X, Y, Z? There's nothing. I didn't say anything at that point. Just to say that I believe in something is a waste of time. It's something which I'm not committing any type of value because I don't really know what it is. Okay. Pesach is writing, modern brain researchers have discovered there are many ways to learn and comprehend in reality. Can we be allowed to be creative thinkers? Any way that you can determine something is truth, Pesach, go right ahead. Okay, I don't see us arguing on anything. All right, so it looks like that's it at this point. Again, this will be posted online if you want to review it. If there's any other questions, I'll wait another moment to see if there's any other questions. Ruthie, you could send an email to info@masora.org. And if there's any other points on this, I feel free to write it now. Otherwise, we'll wrap up the class in just a few moments, in about 5 minutes or so. But keep in mind that Moses, again, called on the people to remember what they saw, and that God orchestrated Sinai as something which would be successfully transmitted as truth throughout all the millennia. And it was. God created an event which was evidence. He wanted there to be a proof, not just to have a belief in something. Again, belief. If you think about it clearly, belief in something does not prove it. So what makes you correct and me wrong if I oppose you? If you have one belief and I have another belief, if I'm going at it with somebody who's from another religion, and he says that he believes that, and I say I believe this, so there's no way to determine who's correct. In order to really understand, if a person's goal in life is to realize what is truth, the only path to truth is to base it on proof and reason. Otherwise, it's just your word against somebody else's, and you're not describing something which is real. That is what our objective is to not live a lie, but to live based on what is true. Okay, thank you for the advice, Pesach. Any other points on the faith or proof? And is it clear? If everything is clear, I hope it was. And again, even after the class, you can feel free to type in an email. Hector is making a good point. Contrast to Christianity's witnesses, the four Gospels that can't agree in what Jesus is supposed to have said or done. That's very true. The four Gospels, Mark and Matthew and Luke, I forget the name of the other one at this point. They're in conflict. If you read through them, you will see that they're in conflict. Additionally, these were not committed to writing until 100 years or so after they claim the miracles. If there were really miracles, like the New Testament says, and that Jesus fed 5,000 men and women with a piece of bread and some fish, whatever they claim, don't you think something like that would have been passed on from that point forward? But if there's absolute silence for 100 years about a miracle that was done to 5,000 people, what that shows you is that the miracle did not take place. Anything which was done en masse, publicly, and it was miraculous, you could not have silence about it. Okay. Lena is writing, we are so bombarded today with information that it is hard to really prove the truth. At the end, I must follow my beliefs. Well, that's taking the easy way out, Lena, and then you're not really coming to a concrete answer. Which religion should you follow in life, then? Judaism? Christianity? Should you be a Buddhist? A Muslim? What are you going to base your choice on? Just because your parents? I mean, people have this the idea that whatever my parents are, that's what I am. No, you are what your mind sees as being true. If you don't see something as true, there's no reason to pick something. If you're picking it because of its appeal, that is not a reason to say that something is true. If your goal in life is not to lie to yourself, and you want to live what you know is true, what we have a limited time here on Earth. We know that death is inescapable. We know that we're put here. We did not create ourselves. The universe didn't create itself. There had to be something which caused the universe. Therefore, this creator, whatever you want to call it, that created the universe, put man here, gave us intelligence, and no other being. Therefore, this creator's will is that we use this intelligence and arrive at what's true. Okay, Gene, thank you. John, the other gospel. So it's Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John. Okay. Okay, Pesach is writing in the end. The integrity of one's own mind is supreme. No, that's not true, Pesach. Whatever your own mind tells you can be completely false. One must be responsible to one's own heart and soul. That is true. The Torah is a guide, not an idol. True. But whatever you're going to determine as being, if you think about this, Pesach, reasoning is something that you are engaged in right now. So in the same sense, your reasoning is an idol, if you want to look at the Torah that way. Meaning to say, what is absolute, unless you don't feel there's anything absolute. So I'd put that to you, Pesach. Is there anything which you would claim in life is absolute? Right. Okay. And Scott has another entry. Let me see what he's saying. I think there's a theme here with some of the listeners. Is a fear that you are banning free thought. Not at all. I'll make it very clear. Free thought is not banned, but a person should engage in and exercise this free thought and develop it. I've been to a few classes on Judaism, and I very much got that sense. Okay, I'm sorry that that is the sense that you got. Scott. I even heard one teacher say, quote, it is not for you to question. You are too small. That's not right. That is a statement that Judaism does not condone. So you should speak to that teacher and ask him where is your source, where is your authority to say that it is not for you to question. As a matter of fact, Maimonides says that a person should ask even 100 times, and the rabbi should even answer the student 100 times. That kind of, I'm continuing Scott's quote, that kind of thing. And really, isn't that Catholic school? Yeah, that sounds like a Catholic school thing, just faith. Yet you said a few minutes ago that you agreed with my comments about the right and obligation of all people to think. Yes, of course. Can you clarify the contradiction? Well, with this person, though, the teacher that you heard, Scott, is not representing Judaism. Right? So there's no contradiction in Judaism. I'm arguing on that teacher. He's wrong to tell you not to think. That's ridiculous. We have a mind and free will for the very purpose that God wants every individual to develop their mind and to think and to ask questions. I always say the worst question, actually not the worst, the only poor question is the one that's not asked. That's what I always told my students. And Scott continues, maybe we are really shooting for a balance between the acceptance of certain postulates and laws as divinely given and developed according to divine sanctioned laws and the freedom and dignity of a person's individual mind. Well, I mean, even these laws, these fundamentals should be proven. You should be questioning on all areas, Scott. And Scott concludes, too often rabbis may be speaking to a modern audience focused on the former. Although I heard of one guy, Joseph Soloveitchik, who seems to discuss both on his website. Okay, Joseph Soloveitchik was one of the greatest minds we had. He passed away years ago, over 10 years ago. And he was a great thinker, and learn as much as you can from his writings. I had learned under a rabbi that was a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zitzal. All right, so I hope that clarifies Pesach, your last. Okay, so you're saying that Hashem is absolute. True. Okay, so that means everything which God said is absolute, Pesach. Okay, so I hope that your last point to be an unwitting enemy of authentic Jewish creativity. Now, be creative. When we learn Talmud, Pesach, when we get together and we learn Talmud, friends and students, it is a very creative session. And when we see the very cryptic writings of the rabbis and what they're getting at and why they wrote that cryptically was in order to drive our thinking towards being creative and to think into the area and to unravel greater ideas. The bottom line is that God's knowledge is infinite. All right? So God couldn't put everything in one book because it's infinite, all his wisdom. But he does give us a book, the Torah, and it's written so cryptically, but it's written in a style that we can now, it was purposefully, in order that we can now extrapolate and induce and deduce new ideas that are true. So it opens up and it unlocks new vaults of wisdom. That's the reason for the cryptic nature of the Torah, is to point us towards more areas. If it was just written clearly and simply and that's it, just read it and memorize it, so then it's a discrete amount of information. But there's an unlimited realm of knowledge that just awaits us. So the way we are directed towards that knowledge is through creativity. So I think we're all really in agreement. And again, those teachers that say, don't question and don't ask or you're too small, that's arrogance, and that teacher is wrong. And there's supposed to be a respect, and there's supposed to be an honesty in terms of what Judaism talks about. Unfortunately, too often, I've seen teachers where they are looking to just grandstand. And if anybody opposes them, they can't say I'm wrong, they can't apologize, and that's it. I recently had a case where I had said something in a newspaper, and it was the wrong statement. At the time that I said it, I used the word ignorant. I was talking about a statement of another rabbi. And it was on this point. He was claiming that faith is what Judaism is based on and not proof. And I hope today everybody comes away with a clear understanding of, based on Moses' words, and Maimonides and Rabbi Bachya, and you'll find all the great leaders as well, all support the idea that proof is what Judaism demands. That's how Judaism is different than every other religion. But what happened was this rabbi wrote in a paper that Judaism is based on faith. I did not feel I could let that go because so many readers would see that statement. I wrote back in, I gave the proofs, as I'm giving to you today, and I made a statement that this rabbi is ignorant of a basic fundamental. However, my intent was not to accuse his person, but to say that he is ignoring something in the Torah. So I used the word ignorant because that means to ignore something. But the way people read it, it sounds like you're accusing the person. Which I accepted, and I wrote back to the paper, and I apologized, not for the point that I made, but for the way it was delivered. So you have to be able to say you're sorry, you have to be able to accept when you're wrong, and you should thank a person when he teaches you something new. I'm just as ecstatic when I find out that I'm wrong than if I find out a new idea. Because then when you find that you're wrong, that's a new insight as well. You were saved from following something which was incorrect. So again, I'm addressing, I'm not sure if that's Scott or Pesach. Scott, you're the one that wrote that. You had a teacher or you heard somebody say you are too small. I mean, that is unfortunate. Too many people go. I mean, I've always thought that, a lot of times people become police officers because they like the power, and a lot of times people become teachers for the same reason. And when their power or the position is being threatened by a student that's half their age, it ruffles their feathers. The ego now perks up, and they say something ludicrous like, "You are too small." Forget it. I was just told a story. It was a good story, very brief. Rav Moshe Feinstein's itself. So Rav Moshe Feinstein, as everybody knows, also passed away over 10 years ago. And a brilliant mind. Nobody today comes close to him in terms of having the breadth of knowledge that he had in Jewish law and Talmud. And there was a story once where you had a student, a young student, and he would constantly ask Rav Moshe every single thing that came to his mind as they were learning Talmud, and Rav Moshe would answer him. And this went on for a while. One of his fellow students came over to this young man, and the one student said to the other one that was perking up a lot, and he says, "It's really not right that you constantly are bombarding Rav Moshe with these constant questions." So the first student felt bad. So the next time he was in class, he kept his mouth shut and didn't say a thing. So the class went on for a while, and after the class, Rav Moshe called over the previously very talkative, inquisitive student, and he says to him, "Young man, I mean, you must not be feeling well today. What's the matter?" So the young man says to Rav Moshe, "No, I feel fine." So Rav Moshe says, "No, it couldn't be. I mean, you're normally asking me questions. You didn't say a word today." So the student says back to Rav Moshe, "Well, the other student told me that it's not proper. I shouldn't be asking so many questions. It's not respectful." So you know what Rav Moshe says back? Rav Moshe says back, "Nonsense. You should ask. This is how you learn, and this is you must ask all the questions." So you see that the great mind, Rav Moshe Feinstein, echoed the truth of Judaism. You ask questions. And Rav Moshe never told them to be quiet. And I know myself when I studied, and I still attend classes by great minds, and you never said, "That's enough questions." This rabbi will never say, "Oh, that's enough questions for today," or to accuse you and to talk about you in terms of your person, though, that you're too small. I mean, that's arrogant speaking. So please, Scott, do not, I'm addressing this to you, and I guess everybody else. Do not let the negative statements of poor teachers taint your image of what Judaism is about. Judaism encourages free thought, but again, the thought should be, you should be raised in thinking properly. That's why it's so important. It's essential. It's crucial that you have a very well-versed Talmudic scholar as your rabbi. Okay. Scott is writing as follows. "I went to an outreach class. The rabbi made a comment. I said, 'What's the source for that?' He said, 'Rashi.' I said, 'I don't know who that is. How do I know he knows better than I do?' So then the teacher said, 'That's very arrogant of you,' and refused to talk to me anymore." Okay. I'm not sure. He may have thought that you were attacking him. I don't know the tone in your voice, Scott. I don't know how he was reading it. You have to be there. But what I would do is make sure that next time you speak this way, ask your words, but make sure it doesn't come off where it can be perceived that way. If you were asking very politely, then he made an error, and he should have given you the benefit of the doubt that maybe you just don't know who Rashi is. Okay, any other questions? Pesach is making a statement. He says that I am encouraging thinking, but the Talmud and the ancient texts have all the answers. Well, that's true. We do have the whole body of thought from Sinai, from Moses. We have all the laws discussed in the Talmud. So we are able to think into it and to give our explanations and to give different reasons too. But in terms of what our actions have to be, yes, that is already concretized. Okay, Pesach? So Jewish law is something which was already formulated in terms of what our actions are. We can give different theories, but I think our goal should be to, first of all, be honest with ourselves. Are we really as great as an Einstein, as Maimonides, as Moses? No, I don't think anybody would make that arrogant claim. Therefore, it behooves us that we should humbly study them and see what they have to say and not try to argue. If we disagree with something clearly and we have a very good, argument, so good. But I think that as somebody who's just, becoming and getting the feet wet in the area, it should be a certain amount of humility. Okay. Tammy in Israel. Nice to see you, Tammy. In your opinion, how can non-religious Jews in Israel express their Jewish... I'm not sure what the... Again, don't be alarmed by the word censored. Sometimes one word can be misspelled or sound similar to another word that's part of a standard list of censored words. So don't worry about that, Tammy. Again, so you want to know, how can the non-religious Jews in Israel express their view, I guess? I had the chance to visit the synagogue in Stockholm last year, and I felt very sad that there was no place like that in Israel where we can practice our Jewish, philosophy, even if we are not Orthodox. Do you have a suggestion or comment? Well, I think, Tammy, in terms of looking to express Judaism is not the goal. What you should be doing is trying to learn more and come to a conclusion as to which, first of all, conservative argues with reform argues with Orthodox and Reconstruction, so they can't all be correct. The first thing is to really prove to yourself which one is the authentic form of Judaism. And if you look at the dates of all of them, you'll see that everything but Orthodox Judaism is a relatively new in the past couple of 100 years, 300 years or so. Prior to that, there was no argument. Ramban, Maimonides, what was the form? It was the Orthodox system. Jewish law, halacha, Talmud. All right, the Shulchan Aruch, which is derived from Talmud. This is going back thousands of years. What you should be is studying and making sure you understand what they are. And I would get I would find, Tammy, a very good Orthodox teacher or classes, and ask questions and study and do exactly what I'm encouraging Pesach and Scott to do, is to ask questions and be honest in your questions. And that should be your goal, should be to find truth, not looking to express what you currently have, because what you may have at the current point may not be accurate. So the real first step, Tammy, should be is the word identity. I'm not sure why that was censored out, Tammy. Definitely, you know, identity is an important thing, but identity is based on what? So if a person can say, I want to express my Jewish identity, and I'm going to drive on the Sabbath to a family party, a family Hanukkah party, well, that's not expressing Jewish identity because you're violating the Sabbath. The Sabbath overrides parties. So it's important that we're guided by what is real Judaism. To break the Sabbath is punished with death in the time of when the Beis Din exists. That means it's severe in the Torah itself. Right, that even Reform has to agree is accurate Torah. There's a story where a man who broke the Sabbath was put to death. He basically, the severity of breaking the Sabbath is because you're not allowing the non-Jews to see you deviating. Meaning when we, like Maimonides says, when we abstain from work, on the Sabbath, what happens is the rest of the world looks at this nation of Jews, and the more that abstain from work, the better, because it's a bigger announcement. It's a bigger spectacle. So when we abstain from work on one day of the week, the other nations look, why? And they ask us, how come you're not working today? Everybody else is. We are then enabled to respond to them and to teach them about creation and further about the seven laws of Noah that they are obligated to keep. When we don't keep the Sabbath, we're not singling ourselves out as being any different, and we are not allowing the other nations that God created as well to come to us and ask questions and learn. Okay, Pesach, thank you very much. And Pesach writes, the Talmud is a fine book, but it itself is not the truth. Okay, we'll have to debate that point because I disagree with you 100% on that Pesach. Tammy is writing, but the world is changing, studying is very important, but having the tradition is also important. Yes, but tradition, Tammy, should be based on what real Judaism is, okay? Tradition is taking my daughters to synagogue. Yes, that's very good, but make sure that what they are learning is proper. If you go to a synagogue and they think that God is really a man, so that is destroying your daughters. Okay, Tammy? I'm giving you a very stark contrast to bring home a point. Lena is writing, I read somewhere that for a religion to keep existing, it has to adopt the needs of the people. We are losing today a lot of Jewish people. Well, that is wrong that a religion should adopt the needs of the people. Because that means to say that God now has to compromise his truths because of people's emotions? No. Yes, we lose a lot of people today because they're not being taught the beauty of the system of Torah. If people would see the reason and the proofs that Judaism has, they would be attracted to it immensely. I was. I know many other people who are. Tammy in Israel writes, the nice Jewish families that I met in Stockholm were very real Jews, in my opinion, even if they came with a car. That's a nice sentiment, Tammy, but it's not true. Somebody who is a real Jew is somebody who is basing his life on what God handed down, not his own subjective feelings. The way Reform and Conservative cropped up was because of people's subjective feelings. Christianity was created because of people's subjective feelings. Now you have so many people doing it, people think that's another argument that it must be true. Oh, look how many Christians there are compared to Jews. Well, that's no argument. If 1 billion people said 2 plus 2 is 5, it would not make 2 plus 2 equal 5. Same thing applies to other religions. Laser is writing. Okay, you're writing something to Tammy. Good. Pesach writes, the Orthodox community has no monopoly on truth. The truth is a tad bigger than Orthodoxy, bigger than all of us included. Okay, Pesach, we have to discuss this more at length. All right? Truth is going to be something that you can prove. Let's just put it at that, Pesach. If there's a specific point that you want to take up right now, then feel free. Yes, Tammy, I agree. It is in Israel that the issue is political. Hillary in Jerusalem is writing, don't most Jews pick and choose what they keep to some extent? Yes, Hillary, and what you're saying is a very good point. You're saying that most Jews pick and choose what they keep. However, do we judge Judaism based on what Jews do, or do we judge Judaism based on what God wrote? That's a very important distinction to make. You cannot look at a Jew and say, this is Judaism, and since this Jew is doing that, then it's wrong, therefore Judaism is wrong. No, your very point actually brings that out. Since most people don't have the strength to stay firm, and that most of the time I feel is because either they have emotional problems with something or their mind just does not see something clearly. But if a person would see the ideas in Judaism clear and they'd prove it to their mind as clear as 2 plus 2 is 4, if they would be able to see the ideas as being perfectly, why is kosher an important thing to do? What is the idea behind tefillin? What is the concept behind the three major holidays? If we would be able to see this clearly, then we would be attached to the truth, because a person's mind will not ignore what makes sense to it. That's the way we're designed. By design, when we see something as true and provable, then we attach to it. It makes sense. And no other faith or belief can uproot what we know is true. So looking at people, you're going to see a lot of corruption. But don't let that be your image of what Judaism is. Okay? All right, Hillary, I hope that answers you. Pesach writes, when the Jewish people cried out in slavery, God himself adopted his ways. Adapted his ways to fit his people. Okay, well, he helped them. Laser, I'm not sure what you're writing over there. You wrote a whole bunch of numbers. I think maybe you tried to put Hebrew in there. I don't know if the system takes that. And Tammy in Israel is writing, I fear that this identity of real Jewishness will cause even more young people to get farther from our tradition and essence as Jews. Tammy in Israel, just do me a favor, write the word that was censored out with dashes like you did before. I don't know if it's the same word. Again, I'll have to see why that, we'll check the system to see why that's being omitted. And Pesach writes, you are right, truth is eternal, therefore it doesn't change. Agreed 100%, Hector. Okay. All right, any other questions at this point? If you have any questions, type them on screen. Okay, let me just reread Tammy's statement. I fear that this attitude of the real Jewishness will cause even more young Jewish people, to get farther from our tradition and essence as Jews. Well, I mean, Tammy, there is only one system that God gave. So there could only be one, one accurate system. And again, the rabbis all unanimously had this view. It's people today that have not even taken the time to study the thousands of years of work that the rabbis put in and the hundreds of years of writing of the Talmud. that, I'll tell you that I have not seen anything in Judaism which goes against reason and that asks for just blind faith. And just the contrary, for the last 3 decades that I've been studying and going through Talmud and Torah and the Chumash and the prophets, what I've seen is a constantly more of a system which is based on how it meshes perfectly with the human personality and how it affords man the greatest enjoyment and pleasure in life. When you see the insights and you see how God wants you to have a good life and why charity is good. I mean, the ideas are just the best proof of the system's validity and than anything. I think what I'd like to do is ask everybody who's online today to have a question for the next time. Maybe we'll do another class this week, if that's something which is available. You could always write in. What might be a good time is, a good thing to do, is to discuss with you now what is the most appropriate time or convenient time for doing the class. So if you'd like to type on screen, a time of day, a.m. and p.m., and also put in your time zone, that'd be helpful. But what I would suggest is that next time we come in, that everybody has a question, like pick something in Judaism that there's a question that you have on. Let's do specifics. Let's take up something specific. If you want to email it in, this way I'll have time to prepare. But that would probably be very helpful to a lot of you. Okay. Let me just read a couple more of the entries. Pesach, you're right. Truth is eternal. Okay. Shmuel in New York are saying, what if I'm not ready to pray? All right. I mean, you have to understand what prayer is. And it has to make sense, too. I mean, nobody can force you to do anything, Shmuel. I mean, there is Jewish law. And prayer has to be something which you're doing because you actually have the need. More than other things, prayer is where you're in dialogue with God. So if you just don't want to be talking to God and you do, that's something which is it could be very problematic. And it really is the antithesis to what prayer is. Prayer is where you recognize God. You know that he exists. You recognize his ability to respond. And you're writing further, Shmuel, he says, should I study the prayers first? For sure. Before I wear tefillin and pray. Yes, and Shmuel, the actual Jewish law is, if you don't know Hebrew, pray in English. Okay, and Shmuel writes further, can you be perfected without praying or caring about tefillah? Is a person bad if they don't pray? It's not a matter of being bad, it's a matter of understanding what prayer is. And I would suggest, Shmuel, I have a few articles here on the website. Search the website. There's a search feature here on Masora, put in the word prayer or praying and read them and get back to me and let me hear your reaction. That the first step is really to understand what prayer is. But keep in mind, you should pray in English because if you don't know what you're saying in Hebrew, it's useless. Okay, Laser writes, we must be careful of the word tradition. There is a religious Jewish movement in Israel called Masort that preaches the change of religious tradition. Okay. Tammy in Israel writes, which one system is the correct one? The one in Bnei Akiva, the one that the rabbi from Gur is promoting, maybe another one. Well, I would go based on, you have a Shulchan Aruch, you have the in terms of practice, Tammy, the Shulchan Aruch is what you need in terms of Jewish law. In terms of knowing philosophy, we have recognized Jewish leaders, Maimonides, Ramban. Buy their books, read them in English, go through the Guide for the Perplexed, or Hirsch, Samson Raphael Hirsch. Whatever language you speak, get the book in that language and read through it. Start learning. If you have questions on specifics, we've had the website here for over 8 years. Use the website. Use Masora right here. You can quickly find an article based on what you're looking for. Type in prayer. Type in Abraham. Type in Tefillin. Type in Mikvah. Whatever it is, use a search, and this way you'll be able to see something right away that addresses your concern, and it's based on the words of these great leaders, and the leaders and the rabbis that I studied under, and again these were all orthodox and clear thinkers. All right, nothing mystical. We're going straight by what we find as being the words of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses, of Joshua, of Maimonides. These are the leaders. That's why this is the thrust of our objective here at Masora is to go back to what the source is. What is the system telling us? Forget about what people do today. You're right, there are so many movements today, and there's so many different flavors, and then there's the Kabbalists, and then there's the Red Strings, the Red Bendels, and then there's the Mystics, and then you have the Kabbalah Center in L.A. You have such nonsense going on, which is complete Christianity, in my mind, And it's been, even the Torah speaks against these red strings, yet Jews do it. And when they're told to stop and they have the source, they still are so obstinate that because they'll make money selling them, they don't follow the Torah. It's amazing. It is amazing. Okay. All right, Shmuel, New York is saying 2:30 is good. Pesach is saying 1 o'clock Eastern. Okay, that's about when we started today. Same as today, Hector says. Okay, free will. Lena would like to discuss free will. Okay. Laser, which system? That was a question earlier. The system, again, Laser and Tammy, is Orthodox Judaism. Okay, and how are you going to understand what Orthodox Judaism is? The Shulchan Aruch, the Talmud, the Torah, read Rashi on the Chumash, read Ramban, Nachmanides, read Maimonides. Use the leaders. All right? If you have questions about what people are saying today, email here. I will hopefully be able to respond to you in a relatively quick time, give you a source, and explain to you. But there's tremendous amount of data that we already have on these main issues here online already. Okay. Further, let's see other questions. Later saying, you know perfectly well that there are so very many interpretations on the ways to practice Torah, so it's not an applicable answer. Tammy in Israel, we have something called the Shulchan Aruch. We have the actual law that's derived from the Talmud. There's no dispute that that is how we are supposed to practice. So I'm not sure what you mean, that there's many different ways. Tammy in Israel's writing, how do you see the woman's place in Judaism? 2006, the same way as it's been since it was given. Okay. I mean, Judaism, I don't understand. A woman, like a rabbi said once, a woman and a man equally have to perfect themselves. Okay? There's not a lesser and a better of the creation. God gave both of us intelligence and the need for perfection. Now, Shmuel, you're writing, should I feel bad when I sin? Yes, that's a natural response, and hopefully maybe a little bit of that guilt that God instills in us will drive us towards doing the good. Hillary in Jerusalem is writing. I am having difficulty reading the messages. Something must be wrong with my computer, but I hope that you can read this. Unfortunately, I get a message without the class. It's too late to join. This time is good for me. Sometimes when I daven, I feel that I'm just saying the words and find it hard to concentrate. Is it better just to say the Shema, for example, than trying to say more without Kavana? Well, you don't have the right to pick and choose, but then again, Hillary, a woman has to daven only once a day, and I don't even know if you have to read the whole thing. I'll have to look into that for you. But it could just be Shmona Esrei. But definitely, if English is better for you, you should be reading English. And find a part of the day that is convenient for you to daven. Okay? Rif Kasari said it's the red string. Rachel's Tomb, red string. What's your question? Red string, what is it? Yes, it's an idolatrous type of practice where people today say that by wearing this string, something in my fate will change. So that's idolatrous. Idolatrous means when you're saying that something outside the workings of regular cause and effect is now going to take place. Like, for example, if a person bows down to an idol and he thinks that that will now provide him some good, it'll protect him. A person does certain things and follows certain, he lights, I don't know, he takes a garlic clove and he lights it, and this will ward off an evil spirit. So again, that's idolatrous. You're assuming that something has an effect which in the laws of cause and effect do not work. Again, Judaism is based on rationality, based on reason. Akum. Yes, exactly, Tammy. Right, the whole thing about the is ridiculous. And it goes against the Talmud, too. It says openly it's the ways of the heathens. Any type of charm, any type of good luck thing, our mezuzah is not for good luck or a protective device. The mezuzah on the door, when you walk into your house, why is it on the doorpost? It's there because that's the part of the house that you see the most. That's where you frequent the most. Because when you go in and out of the house, you have to pass through the doorway. God said, put a mezuzah there, write the Shema, in order that you just recall the ideas of the fact that I exist whenever you enter into your house. The house is something which you look at as a protective thing. Oh, my house. Look how much people invest into their homes because they look at their house as being something that protects me. But God says, in that area, put a mezuzah. Just remind yourself that your real security in life is not coming from your home. It's coming from me. I will decide your fate. If you're living properly, God will take care of a person. If a person is not living properly, God will abandon that person. And I'd like to just give you a very nice idea. So I hope everybody, let's hold off on the typing for a second. Everybody listen to this idea. Since you brought up Tammy, the red string. Okay, the idea of mezuzah and tefillin and tzitzis. Let me just ask everybody right now. Does everybody online right now in the class? Does everybody know what a mezuzah, the tefillin, and tzitzis are? Just write yes or no on screen. Is everybody familiar with mezuzah, tefillin, and tzitzis? Is that something which everybody's familiar with, or should I explain what those three objects are? Yes or no on screen? Let me just see feedback from you. Okay. Okay. Now, I just maybe we'll close. Well, we can continue. I mean, it's fine with me if you want to discuss more. Let me just give you a little insight in terms where you will start having an appreciation for the beauty of the system. Okay, Scott says no. Okay, looks like a few people don't know. And Lena says no. Okay. The mezuzah is basically the Shema. It talks about 10 main principles in Judaism: God's unity, that He exists, reward and punishment, the Exodus from Egypt. So, main principles are discussed in the Shema. The Shema is then written. The Shema refers to a small portion in Deuteronomy, and it's written on a small piece of parchment, rolled up, or it could be unrolled, I believe, and placed. Actually, let me retract that. I'm not sure if it'd be rolled or not. Usually, it is rolled. And it's affixed to the doorpost. That's a mezuzah. Tefillin has that section plus more. And then they're black boxes. One is worn on the head and one is worn on the arm. So the tefillin is on the body. And tzitzis are the strings that you'll see the religious people wearing. It's whenever you wear a four-cornered garment. So you should put tzitzis, strings, on the four corners. So the rabbis say that anybody who has a mezuzah on his house, tefillin on his head, and tzitzis on his body will not sin. But let's go into this more. What are these three things? What is the connection between the tzitzis, the tefillin, and the mezuzah? Well, if you think about it, the mezuzah we just said is affixed to the house. The tefillin are put on your body, and the tzitzis are worn on your clothing. Now, just think about that for a second. I want you to think about another area too that has these three objects, I mean the house, the body, and your clothing. In the older times, and when a person was worthy, if a person spoke what we call lashon hara, evil speech, if you spoke derogatory statements about another human being, you would get leprosy on your home. Your house would be smitten. If you didn't stop the talk and you didn't repent, then the leprosy would move to your clothing. If you still kept on speaking evil speech, then finally the leprosy would attach itself to your body. Right? The same three objects: the house, the clothing, and the body. Here also you have a house, clothing, and a body. Now the question is, what's the connection? See, psychologically, and a person must learn about psychology if you're going to understand the Torah. Psychologically speaking, a person puts a security in these three areas. A person puts a lot of security in his house, where he's protected from the elements. And you see that people invest a lot in their home. A person puts greater security or identity in his clothing. You see how a person dresses is a big statement about who they are. Clothing has so many different styles and fashions because people have different emotions, different things they want to express about themselves. So you're making a statement by the way you dress, which is fine. There's no law that you can't dress as long as it's modest. And the last area of security is a person's body. And you see that expressed in people who work out. I mean, and health is definitely an important thing. Again, not to an extreme, not to where the body becomes the be-all and end-all. Well, your body is something you should take care of. But if it's to the point where a person is just spending hours and hours every single day just beautifying the body and ignoring the mind, then the body is now being misused. But you see, the body is something which a person identifies with, because that's him. That's what a person really looks at as themselves. Because of that, God says, put a mezuzah on your house, meaning redirect your real concept of security towards God. Said a mezuzah reminds you of God. When you enter into your house and you're about to take pride and security in your own home, stop and look at the mezuzah. Remember who put you here and who put you here for a limited amount of time and who provides for you. When you put on your clothing, put on tzitzis, meaning remind yourself again in the area where, again, you express your identity and your security in the self. Remind yourself that God is the one that you should be looking towards in terms of having a relationship with and in getting what your needs are in life and the one that you should pray to. And then when you start to invest in your body, any type of identity, put the tefillin on. The tefillin go on the body. Okay? So the body is something which also you have to address. So you see, in these three areas where a person places security, God's system of the Torah asks a person to redirect his security to the correct area. Okay? And precisely because a person identifies with these three, that's where God would send leprosy, or tzaras. Okay, I see that somebody is disputing. I'm not going to go into whether it's leprosy or not. Tzaras. It's something which is an undesirable thing. Because God does not want to hurt a person initially with a body. So he'll give a warning. If you're speaking bad, your house will get hit. If not, then your clothing. The clothing is you could deny less that I did something wrong now, because it's on my clothing and not somebody else. If I still deny I did something wrong, then God puts this tzaras, this disease on your body. Now it's undeniably you. Now you got the message. You see, God does the least amount of damage first in order just to give a warning. He does it from the distance. The house, then a little bit closer, a little bit closer, it goes to your clothing, and then finally to the body. But you see now how, based on the design of a human being, psychologically, God will design a system of Torah around that. And now we have a nice appreciation for what mezuzah is about, what tefillin is about. All right, you put the tefillin on your head and on your arm. You put it on your head, which corresponds to the intelligence, the brain. And you put it on your arm across from your heart that corresponds to your emotions. They're both your intelligence and your emotions, the two parts of the human being, the intelligence, the head, the emotions, the arm. You should both be subjugating both of those parts of you to God. Okay? Okay, let's go back on screen for just the last few questions. Okay, laser is writing. Is it better to do some mitzvos or none? Well, definitely do some. He continues writing. So what if some people observe only some of them? Will this lead to greater observance? It will, yes, laser, as long as the person is learning about them and sees the beauty behind them. Pesach writes that God's unity is supremely mystical. Well, if you mean hidden, I guess that's where your thinking is at. Okay. Test is writing, tzitzis for both men and women or just men? Well, the custom now is men. The custom now is that the men wear the tzitzis. Tam in Israel, but as a woman, I have only a mezuzah and no tefillin or tzitzis. Well, Rashi's granddaughters used to wear tefillin. Right? So there's not a prohibition on the women for tefillin and tzitzis. It's just that that is just not the custom today. That is all. It's not a prohibition. Okay. Lena is writing, so then it is a selfish motive to use these articles rather than expression of faith. Very good, Lena. You're making a very good point. Yes, Judaism is very selfish. In the same way that a boy is boyish, right, or a girl is girlish. It's not a negative thing to say, hey, that's a boyish suit, or that's a boyish shirt. No, you're saying it possesses the characteristics of a boy. So Judaism possesses the characteristics of the self, meaning to say that a person is looking for the self, the best self-interest in Judaism. And we should understand why we're doing the mitzvot. Rabbi once said that Rashi states, if a person does a mitzvah, a command, and has no understanding why he's doing it, then it's useless. Meaning to say that the whole purpose in doing, fulfilling a command is that you see with your mind that this is a correct activity. This makes sense. So now, in action, I am now expressing what my mind tells me is true. Again, we come full circle to what we started the class with today. And that is that we live a life based on reason, and we should use reason, and we should see how the system of Torah, that every aspect of it, is created by God, the all-knowing being, and he understands how he made man psychologically, and he knows exactly what we need in terms of perfection, and he gave it to us. And every system in the Torah system of laws of kosher or laws of prayer. And every mitzvah in the Torah, every command, targets man's well-being. And it's wise that we understand them as much as we can. Okay. Pesach is writing, your talk on leprosy is real reasonable. You reject or embrace mysticism when it suits you. No, I completely reject mysticism altogether, Pesach. Let me just make that clear. Mysticism is not something which I buy into at all. And I don't see Judaism as mystical. Throughout the Talmud, the Torah, everything is based on sensibility, what is proven. Right? Moses never asked the people once just to buy into some mystical nonsense. Okay? All right. Shmuel in New York asks, if you get cancer or disease, is it a punishment? Well, it could be. We don't have a prophet telling us whether our disease was from God or not. It could be. We have to, the Talmud says, to reflect on your ways and see. A lot of times a person could get diseases because they don't take care of themselves, and it's self-inflicted, but they don't look at it. They didn't look at the fact that for so many years they were drinking so much, and now they have liver disease. Now all of a sudden they think the liver disease is something which is the God sent to them. All right. Rivka Sari writes, not prohibited, but women is not obligated. Correct, Rivka, yes, regarding tefillin and tzitzis. Tammy in Israel is writing, is there an explicit prohibition on women to become rabbis? There is no obligation for women to teach, so the men are the ones that have the role to teach. Even today, the status of rabbi is something which is not the same as it was back then, but it was given over to the men, because men have the obligation to learn, they're the ones that have the obligation to teach. But you had women throughout history that were leaders. Right? A man does not have any monopoly on perfection of thought. Okay. Well, yes, Lena, you're writing that it sounds like Judaism is selfish for personal gain rather than for the glory of God. Well, when you are, that's a good point you're making. When a person is living their life and they're following the laws of Judaism, they are looking in order to see more about God. That is a person's goal, is to have Avas Hashem, love of God. So a person is, but he's not always reflecting on the self. He does not like taking a measuring stick every second and saying, okay, how much love of God do I have now? Or let me realize that now I'm doing this for the love of God. A person should get to the point where they're just attracted to learning and to knowledge. That's called Torah Lashma, learning for the sake of seeing the ideas. That's the highest level. And a person should also be teaching, and that's going to be for the glory of God. And when a person acts properly, that will now impress on other people that the system that God gave is a good system. Scott is writing, if Torah was created before the world, why do the stories of the Bible seem to unfold as if spontaneously? Was every choice Abraham made destined to be or just known beforehand? When we say the Torah is written before the world, it means to say the primary concepts of God's unity, of worship of God, of the truths that God is not physical, that he is a creator, and all the different ideas about morality. But not, no, Abraham had free will. His life was not scripted. Right? There was no such thing as destiny in terms of Judaism. We don't say that you were destined to be this or that. You have certain propensities. You have a certain ability. Like, everybody has a certain ability. I'm not going to be an Einstein. Right? I just don't have that makeup to be an Einstein. Certain people have a breadth of thought and knowledge, like Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, or the Rav, Rav Soloveitcher, Moses, or Maimonides. We are not like them. But we all equally share in free will and mapping out our own life. We have the ability to overcome sin. We have the ability to see truth. Nothing was destined. Even by Paro, God did not cause him to choose something. So you have to understand what it means that he hardened his heart. Right? Different discussion, not for now. Baruch in California writes, the men need to wear tzitzis and tefillin to feel closer to God. It's not to feel closer, as I said earlier. It's a means of perfecting a certain idea, that we should subjugate ourselves in our bodies as well as our clothing, that we should not look into these objects for security. But there are much more ideas in them as well. Women are naturally closer to God than men are, so they do not need to wear tzitzit and tefillin. Well, I don't see where that is proven that women are naturally closer. You could say that women are less involved in acquisition and in going after building empires. In that sense, I would agree. I mean, it says in the Talmud that wise men, the Talmidei Chachamim, The wise Torah scholars are equated to women in the sense that they are more in tune with not going out and building empires and conquering the world, but the Chacham, the wise men, are more involved in, they're removed from that. They're not interested. They know they're going to live 80, 90 years if they're lucky. So they don't place all their energies in life in terms of the physical, in that sense. But purely to say a woman is more perfected than a man, you have to look at each individual. So that statement I've heard before, and I disagree. It makes no sense to me. Shmuel in New York is writing, does God ever listen to when you pray? Yes, God knows everything. Can you still be a good person if you don't pray? I find it difficult to pray, but still follow most of the system. Okay. I mean, Shmuel, if you want, we could talk more about it. And you could give me specifics. If you could write me personally. There's a contacts link here on the website. So feel free to write me, and I'll see if I can address specifics in terms of what the issues you are with prayer. Lena writes, when I think of what God really wants from us, I was answered that he wants us to glorify him, not us. Okay, that is true, but that does not mean he does not want us to have an enjoyable life. Why did God create such delicious foods? Why so many of them? Why such beautiful birds and beautiful scenery? God created also human emotion, satisfaction, the feeling of satisfaction, the feeling of pleasure. This is all purely something that God wants man to have enjoyment. Now, of course, we should, on the highest level, use these and enjoy these and partake of these in our pursuit of the good. Eating should not just be an end in itself. We should invite the poor people to our house when we eat. We should give of our money when we become wealthy. And even when we're not, we should give 20% of our earnings. Another example would be, again, it's true also that when you say glorify God, you mean to say to help others see the truth in life. Yes, that's the whole purpose of this class. The whole purpose is for us to exchange ideas and to discuss and to get to the truth. Okay, Shmuel in New York says, reflect on your ways doesn't help because you will never know. I completely disagree with you, Shmuel. Reflect and you can. And discuss and get a good teacher. Okay, Laser, I'm not sure you're writing, is prohibited for lo ilbash. And Pesach writes, people get leprosy from their behavior. That is what the Torah discusses. Yes, Miriam, Moses' sister, received tzara'as, leprosy, because she spoke poorly about her brother, Moses. Okay, Tammy in Israel, my pleasure, Tammy. You're welcome. Pesach writes, that cannot be proven in any reasonable medical school. I'm not sure what you're writing about there, Pesach. All right, since it is prohibited for lo ilbash. I don't know what you mean, lo ilbash. Shmuel writes, how can you reflect on what you did and why does that help if we never know if God's punishing us? We do know, based on what the Torah says is sin and what the Torah says is proper activity, we can now use that as a barometer to see whether we're acting properly. We reflect on our actions and see if there's something that we did. And if we got sick, and because we got sick, we then reflected on our ways, and then we found out, hey, you know, I did the wrong the other day. So again, we don't know whether or not God gave us the illness, but we did arrive at a new observation about ourselves. So that's what a person should do. When I say that you should reflect and you could never know, you're right. What you said, you can reflect and never know, you mean you can never know if God sent it to you. That's true. But you can know if you did something incorrect. So that's why reflection is important, because you can arrive at an observation of yourself if you did something wrong. Okay, Pesach is writing, I will be who I will be. This small inner voice commands my loyalty, not to the voice of men. Well, Moses was a man, so I'm not sure if you're arguing on what Moses said, Pesach. Okay, Tammy in Israel writes, my daughter wanted me to ask, why did God punish Eov in such a terrible way? Okay, it's a large story, Eov. Briefly, Eov was not punished, but he was left up to a... it's a good question. He was left, I can only answer you why he was punished. He was not punished, but he was left up to the laws of nature. And whatever was going to happen to him did. And again, Maimonides says it was not a real story. It was a lesson. So it did not really take place, but the ideas are true. I mean, to say that a person can have a terrible life if he's outside of the truth, meaning inasmuch as a person has wrong ideas about God, so he's removed from God, and God's providence does not relate to him. Maimonides proves this from the Torah, where he shows that each person, based on their level of perfection, God was involved in their life at a higher degree. Moses was at the greatest degree of perfection, and God was involved with him throughout the day. He didn't even have to be unconscious, like all the other prophets, for God to speak to him. Abraham, who was on a lower level than Moses, the Torah says that God was involved with him, but in a lesser manner. And so on down the line. The lesser the person's perfection, the lesser God is involved. And to the point, like King David says, if a person is like a behemoth, like an animal, so then he is left up to the laws of chance, just like the animals are. God does not control which deer should be caught by which lion, so the lion can satisfy his stomach. So there's no providence over the divine, I mean, there's no divine providence over the individual species, Maimonides says. Excuse me, the individual members of the animal kingdom. Over man, there can be God's divine providence over an individual, but it's only connected to how perfected his thought is. Now, Eve had the wrong idea. He felt life was great, and he worshipped God as long as he had wealth, and he had his children, and he had his home, his property. But his whole basis for serving God was only because he had a good life. Now, once tragedy struck, he started questioning, how could this happen to me? How could this happen to me? Meaning, he had the wrong idea why he should be observant. He should have been observant and followed God because he saw the truth. Not because he had a good life or not, but a person should follow the truth because he sees it's the truth. We're designed to be attracted towards the truth. That's why it's so important that we teach others and we share new knowledge that we have with our friends and our family and help them see that Judaism is a system based on proofs and truth and purely reasonable ideas. Nothing on blind faith. Eve, however, started questioning God. How could this happen to me? But it was precisely because of that lifestyle where he was only good because he had wealth and children and material success. That's why he was good. So that did not entitle him to be protected when certain calamities would happen, naturally. Therefore, it wasn't until he raised himself with the help of his friend Elihu. Elihu taught him the right ideas and said, Eve, do you know how the ostrich lays its eggs, or how these animals work, or how the heavens work? And when Eve finally realized that, no, I can't answer these questions, I don't even understand how the physical universe works, Elihu then showed him, therefore, how could you have a complaint against God's justice? If you don't know how the physical world works, how can you say how God's system of justice works? Justice is much more abstract than the physical world, at least the physical world you can see. So once he agreed and he saw this idea, and he agreed that he made a mistake, and he admitted that he was wrong, then God stepped in and gave him back even more children, even more wealth, and his health. So you see that the story teaches that ignorance can be something which can cause a person to be removed from God to the point that great tragedies he will not be spared from, like the tsunami, like what happened in Louisiana, right? The Indiana now with the tornadoes. People who are completely righteous will be saved. And that we see. We have stories in the Torah. Stories in the Torah will tell us that the people who are righteous were saved, right? Then the people who are wicked are drowned. The Red Sea, the splitting of the Red Sea. The Jews were saved, the Egyptians were killed. The three friends of Daniel that were thrown into a fiery furnace, they were miraculously saved from the fire. But another person who's not righteous would not be saved from the fire, all right? Like Haman in the time of Purim, or the Greeks in the time of Hanukkah. So we see that you can be subject to great tragedy. Okay, let's just hold off 1 second on the entries. I just want to see the questions. I hope that answers your question, Tammy. Laser. All right, so again, Tammy, just to wrap up the question, you can tell your daughter that the reason why Eve received such tragedies is because he was not living properly. Therefore, God did not relate to him. But once he corrected his thoughts and his actions, then God came back into his life and removed all the tragedy. Okay. All right, Laser, I will check and see about the censoring. Thank you. Scott is writing, there is a sign on a building near my work that has a picture of a bearded Jewish looking man with a hat, and underneath it says Rebbe Moshiach. What does that mean? That's a Lubavitch sign. The Lubavitch have this notion that their deceased leader is the Messiah. Okay, it's a wrong idea. Shmuel, New York, writes, you don't have to be at a high level for God to punish you. Why should God punish me if I'm not in a high level? Well, God, King Solomon said, those who God loves, does he punish? Meaning, if you're going to look at something negative in your life as possibly God's punishment, then he'll give it to you. But if a person will not reflect on tragedy in his life, God won't bother giving him a punishment because it won't help the person learn a lesson. God doesn't just punish unless he's trying to correct the person. And the only way he can correct the person is if the person stops, views the punishment as something possibly from God, and then reflects and perfects himself. He finds his flaws and he moves further. All right, Shmuel, I'm glad you enjoyed the class. Okay, Pesach, shalom to you too. Shmuel writes, are most people under divine providence? How do you get divine providence? Is there a magic formula? Well, Shmuel, the more a person is in line, again, and this is based on the verses in the Torah. The higher level of the person, the more God was involved so in the person's life. And the way that God is more in your life is by studying what's true and following the system that God gave, following the Torah. Shmuel, New York, writes, and I'll take this as the last question, unless I see any more come on in the last few minutes. Although, I think I said that an hour ago. Shmuel, New York, writes as follows. Am I allowed to have bad thoughts? Should I repress them? If you're not supposed to have bad thoughts, that's simply, that's implying that it's bad or wrong to think of bad things. But sometimes you can't control your mind. Right, you're not punished for, you have thoughts that come across your mind. That's just, it's uncontrollable. You try to be involved in the best that you can, Shmuel. But again, remember, it's a process, and don't beat yourself over the head with guilt. Get on the right track. Make sure you're putting as much time to learning as possible. Use your mind to see truth. All right, Tammy, I'm glad you enjoyed the thing. If you like Tammy, there actually is a we just finished, coincidentally, putting together a compilation on Eve in English. So if you'd like to send an email to the website, just request a copy of that, and we'll make sure that you get one. Okay, and this way your daughter can go through it as well. All right, I think that wraps up all the questions at this point. So, let me wish everybody a good day. I hope the class was enjoyable, and the class will be posted online shortly. So, if you missed any part of the class, you will be able to hear it, and you can stay tuned to the live classes link. It's the first link on your left-hand side, just underneath our logo. And that will have the schedule of classes. And again, I saw some people wanted to do a class on free will. Other topics, feel free to write in with them. This way we can cover topics. And at the same time, we may have addressed in the past many of the topics that you'd like to do. So use the search feature on the site. Okay. And Scott is asking that you say that Lubavitch people are operating from the wrong idea regarding their messianic belief. Yet they work from the same books and tradition as you, don't they? And they have scholars, don't they? Does this show that the correct tradition isn't so clear? Just because you work from a book that's the same as somebody else's does not mean that you can't make a mistake. And it doesn't mean that a lot of people can't make a mistake. I mean, look at conservatism and reform. So yes, I am saying that the Lubavitch people, with this idea to say that this person who is dead is the Messiah, is a false idea. It doesn't matter how many of them are there. It doesn't matter that they're working from the same book, right? There are Jews that I am sure think that God is physical somehow. Okay, look at the Christians that used the Bible, and they went astray too, and they said God is a human being. Okay, Alberto Gorin, good to see you again. Thanks for coming in today. The next class will be scheduled, so again, look at the live classes link. We will announce it by email, so you can join. Okay, that will wrap it up for today. I wish everybody a good day, and stay tuned for the classes, and I look forward to seeing you all soon. Okay, be well. Good day to everybody.